Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. There's been a lot happening since the last time we talked a couple of weeks ago. First item I'd like to talk about is what's going on in Libya as that thing is finally winding down. And I saw an interesting thing on Drudge yesterday. They called it the final battle. We've got Gaddafi running around out in the desert. His sons are out there. How is this all going to really wind down, Jim?
All right, they've got over 100 tribes in Libya. Many of them have kept quiet for the sake of unity, but they still have all their, everyone has a list of things they want. And the lists often conflict. There are several key players in the National Leadership Council, the Rebel Council, as it were, who are angling to get more attention, to get more money, so they can basically buy more votes. I mean, buy more votes in the sense that anybody does it, United States, even in Europe. And the problem is, will they be able to do that peacefully? Because a lot of these tribes feel aggrieved. Only maybe 10-20% of the population did fairly well under 40 years of Gaddafi's rule, even though the oil revenue was bringing in a per capita income of $14,000, and that's pretty high. But the country was a controlled, essentially planned economy, and it was terribly inefficient, and basically people were just getting more and more miserable. On top of that, about 25% of the work was being done by imported workers, either because they had skills that no Libyans had acquired, or because they were doing work. I mean, it's that thing throughout all the oil countries, especially the Arab oil countries, certain dirty work, they'd rather be unemployed and hire a foreigner to do it, move the garbage, stuff like that. So they have all these problems. And of course, the most immediate ones is the fighting, which entails a lot of, Gaddafi's people firing off, 40-year-old ammunition, which wasn't necessarily accurate, but they were firing at cities, so it hit something. The coastal areas, many of the coastal areas, Misrata, even a lot of Tripoli is a messy utility, sanitation, water, electricity, and what have you. So for the next month or so, they're going to concentrate on getting all that together. Then comes the showdown. There's still $1 trillion worth of oil in the ground. And who's going to get it? Who's going to get how much? Now, a lot of the people in Libya, especially the people running the various tribes and factions, they know how this works. If you can get your hands on the oil, export operation and get the money sent to an office you control, you can take some of it. Now, the trouble is everybody knows this. This has been going on for a long time, and a lot of people in Libya are saying, look, either we share it up equitably, which means, for example, have transparent, have publication of the transactions, which hardly any Arab oil state does. It's all kept in the dark, purposely, for good reason. So there's going to be a big argument over the transparency thing, a big argument over the equitable distribution of the oil, a big argument over how much we're going to punish the people who basically lived off all the oil revenue for the last 40 years. Now, you can see where this is going. A lot of these things contradict one another. The Gaddafi tribe isn't very big, 100 and some thousand people. But he made deals with several other tribes which are larger, who basically benefited. So there's going to be a lot of this finger-pointing. You son of a gun, you were quizzling, et cetera, et cetera. So it all comes down to, how quietly can they handle this? Now, as we've seen in the Middle East, these things normally aren't handled quietly. Look what's happening in Iraq. Look what's going on. Well, Afghanistan isn't even in the Middle East. But, you have these countries which were never known for their good government, or fair or functioning government. And now they're trying to basically get something more modern going, and the track record has not been all that encouraging. So all I can tell you that's going to happen in Libya, it's going to be interesting, and the media is going to love it. I'm not saying the Libyans are going to like it very much.
Dan, let me add something to that. A thought, though, that Libya has got going for it that Iraq and Afghanistan haven't. I mean, first, the obvious thing is location, 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 and an easy shipment across the Med to European markets for its petroleum, for its petroleum products. There have a lot of Western companies that have been doing business in Libya now for decades. Yes, in some ways co-opted by the Gaddafi regime, but they're there. They're transparent on their European or international end. And there's some hope for improved transparency if they work with the oil companies that are experienced there inside Libya. That's going to take some degree of trust, not just simply by the transitional National Council, the Libyan acting Libyan rebel umbrella group, but also from the point of view of the international companies as well. So I'm not disagreeing with what Jim said. I just point out that Libya may have a little bit of an advantage there in terms of being able to settle on that point.
Well, it all comes down to the problem throughout the Middle East, that people have to decide, can we govern ourselves? And at least now they're all, most countries that they're at the point, and this is a problem. You know, it's just not ordained by Allah that, you know, we will be ruled, you know, perfectly. Because that was what was going around 30, 40 years ago. All we got to do is have a united Arab state and everything will be hunky-dory. And that fell apart, you know, with ugly repercussions. And then you got all these strong men, you know, Nasser came in, hey, I'm a dictatorship for everybody's benefit. Yeah. You think we would have learned something from World War II and the Bolsheviks. But anyway, now people have learned. Most people, especially younger people, they say, hey, look, don't give me any of this socialist crap or, you know, any of this other, even the Islamists, you know, are a minority. They're just simply a very violent minority. People are saying, look, we have a problem and we're not really going to be better off unless we solve it. Even the Saudis are behind that, although they don't want to give up their kingdom, which is, there it goes. There's the problem in a nutshell.
Well, this is a sea change, though, Dan, from spending all your time blaming the West and blaming...
Oh, yeah, that's gone. They say that's 1980s, so to speak.
It's huge. It's huge, and this is a step towards you know, modernization is difficult. You know, feudalism, tribalism, and the like, but it's a step towards successful modernization. I mean, that's noted by a number of people. You know,
learning to disagree is difficult, and of course, they got to be careful because America's showing that you can lose that capability.
Right. Well, it's going to be very interesting to watch how it winds down. Now, the chances are that this could end up being a long, drawn-out guerrilla war, right?
Yes and no. The people, I mean, first of all, there aren't many, 8-9 million. Secondly, only half of the GDP is oil. Now, granted, a lot of the other half is spin-off, you know, from, you know, economic activity created by the oil mining. But there is a lot of pent-up entrepreneurship in Libya. A lot of the overseas, you know, Libyans, the ones who left over the years, were the entrepreneurs because they did very well. You find a lot of, you know, Libyan businessmen all over, you know, Europe and even in America, why not? Some of them may come back. Some of them may run away real quick when they realize how chaotic it is. But the potential is there. It's all a question of where they put their priorities. Initially, everybody just wants, you know, drinkable water and the lights to come on. And it's after that, you know, as the oil, and of course, get the oil flowing again. At that point, it's the crunch time. All right, we got lights are on, we got water to drink, you know, the roads are repaired, you know, people can eat, the oil is flowing. Now what? So, 6 months down the line. By Christmas. Chaos by Christmas.
Chaos by Christmas.
Have a chaotic New Year.
Now, there's been a lot
happening over in Israel that actually hasn't gotten a lot of press. Some of it has, and probably as we were talking before we started our recording here, the part that's gotten the most press is probably the least interest or the least happening thing. And that was the press was writing a lot about Israel repositioning its ships and Iran repositioning its forces. What's really going on there, Jim?
Two things. One, the Iranian fleet is not much. You know, it's basically a lot of press releases. It depends on what you believe. That's how powerful their fleet is. But they do have a couple of operational kilo-class subs they bought from the Russians in the 90s. They've got a couple of new warships, which they build, which are basically, you know, the naval equivalent of, you know, movie sets. And they've got some older ships, which are held together with baling wire, you know, and glue. But what they did discover was when they sent a couple of ships through the Suez Canal, you know, earlier in the year, that got them a lot of attention. And attention is what they want. Because the one operation in Iran that gets a lot of funding and a lot of deference is the Quds organization. And that's their special forces from the dark side. In other words, the Quds force is meant to go out anywhere it can and start terrorism campaigns, get Islamic radicals going. You know, our special forces are supposed to go out and start, you know, revolutions and what have you to throw out oppressors. Well, Quds basically says the same thing, except by their reckoning, any country with Muslims in it is oppressed, and all the non-Muslims must either be converted or thrown out. They are all over the place, and a lot of problems, Syria, for example, can be traced right back to these guys. But they live, they thrive on media attention. In other words, when they come recruiting for suicide bombers or whatever, gunfighters, they need that recognition. And Iran gets it by doing stuff. Now, they can't do anything too outrageous because if anybody shoots back, they fall apart. They know that. I mean, the Iranians are smart. That's why they've been top dog in that part of the world for 4,000 years or so. So they realize that if they can do something that isn't too provocative, gets a lot of media, looks heavy duty, goes down with the young guys who Quds wants to recruit, it's all good. Now, the other thing they've been doing is sending ships, surface ships, through the Suez Canal, and that's a way they could clandestinely deliver weapons to Hezbollah or even Syria, because nobody's going to inspect the warship. That's basically verboten, you know, a cargo ship. But hey, you can put a lot of weapons and what have you on one of these, you know, frigates and what have you, and then just take it through to Latakia, you know, whatever, and drop it off, and you know, bingo, you're off. You're back for another load. So they have plenty of opportunities here, but none of them have anything to do with Iran asserting its naval power. It has no naval power to assert.
Dan, let me add something real quick to that. I did a column on this, which is up on the strategy page and on point, called The Great Fright Fleet.
Yeah.
Joke off of the Great White Fleet from Teddy Roosevelt, but that's what I call the Iranian fleet. It was two ships, a frigate that was in suspect shape and a naval supply ship that was rather large and likely packed with weapons for Hezbollah and Hamas. And that's one of the passages of Iranian naval vessels that went through the Suez Canal that Jim was referring to. That occurred earlier this year, I think late January, early February, off the top of my head. And it was a media propaganda move. And combination, media attention, you know, we'll send our fleet out there. It was the first time, and I think it was off the top of my head, 25 or 30 years had been an Iranian naval ship in the Mediterranean. They got their propaganda pop, and likely since it docked in Syria that there was the weapon shipment. I just call listeners' attention to that because that'll flesh out some of the discussion we're having here.
Well, now the thing that has been happening that is probably underreported is the number of rocket attacks that has taken place over the last month.
Well, they've got another ceasefire. Now, there were two theories on that whole business with the rocket attacks. One was that it was basically ordered by Iran, which may be true. Not Hamas, but there are several smaller terror groups enjoying sanctuary in Gaza, which are known to be financed and supported by Iran. And these are the guys who run out there and say, you know, they basically tell Hamas, you know, ceasefire, schmeasefire, we're going to fire at the Jews. And they fire off a couple of rockets which hit nothing. But at one point, and this is where Hamas got in trouble, there was a flurry, dozens of factory-made, 122 millimeter rockets, which can go out 20 kilometers or more. One of these barrages got through the Iron Dome system, saturated it, we ripped that up, and killed somebody. And this got the Israelis very, very, very mad. And they began bombing a lot of valuable terrorist targets. And apparently the pastor word is, you know, we're getting the tanks ready, boys, you know, so get ready. And Hamas turned on a dime and said, hey, you know, they started clamping down on the smaller players and told, Israel, wait up. And this, of course, came after that ambush action down by Eliyat as well. That's what really triggered the heavy response from Israel. The rockets, even if one person was killed, you know, they're dealing that. But basically Hamas and the Egyptians were basically let, carloads of terrorist gunmen, go racing down these desert highways. Now, the Egyptians are making an attempt. They sent several thousand troops this last month in August up into the Sinai, and they got the Israelis to agree to a modification of their peace treaty, which basically forbids certain types of Egyptian military from going into the Sinai, namely, armored vehicles and certain types of aircraft. The Israeli says, we're giving you an exemption, so take care of these schmucks. So that changed the whole, playing board as far as Hamas was concerned. Oh my God, if the Egyptians are on our case again. Plus, Hamas has another problem, which is rarely talked about, in that all these little terrorist groups they have allowed to take up, sanctuary in Gaza, they now constitute a formidable amount of firepower. Indeed, a lot of them are united in a loose coalition, and they're telling Hamas to back off or else. So Hamas now sees itself losing control of parts of Gaza, not to Fatah, which has been largely neutered, but to these, holier-than-thou, more Islamic-than-thou, other Islamic radical groups. And this has always been a problem in the Palestinian, governments. The radicals will say, you don't hate the Jews, you don't hate Israel enough, and what have you. And for years, they got away with playing it both ways. In the Arab language media, they'd say Israel has no right to exist, Israel must be destroyed. But then in English or non-Arab language, they say, no, we're willing to make a peace deal. Now, of course, that's been pretty much blown out. It's been publicized what they've actually been doing all these decades. And even the UN is getting a little leery of being too supportive of the Palestinians. This is bubbling just beneath the surface this month and next when the Palestinians try and get the motion passed in the UN to declare a Palestinian state unilaterally without any input from Israel. This is going to be big news, the two-faced attitude of the Palestinians. But at the same time, Hamas has the same old situation Fatah found itself in, splitting and splitting and splitting. And of course, what annoys the Arab world the most is the fact that, and this has been said for years and years, openly in many, especially the Gulf countries, the Palestinians have to unite. And what are they doing? They're splintering even more. So this is what the Israelis are basically taking advantage of now. And this is what annoys the heck out of the Iranians, because they see a big possibility they're going to lose Syria. And at the same time, they're going to lose their foothold they've gotten in Gaza, which is pretty, the foothold in Gaza was sort of an unexpected present for Iran, because they are Shia. And almost all of the Islamic radical groups in Gaza are Sunni, which means for Islamic Sunni Islamic radical Shia heretics, which must be killed. But Hamas, as they did with Al-Qaeda, they managed to, you know, use the enemy of my enemy is my friend, you know, excuse, and said, look, let's get together for the greater good of, you know, destroying Israel. But that is falling apart. So Iran, a year ago, they looked like they were on top of the world, and suddenly, you know, they're slipping. And they're slipping, and they see no end in that slippage. So that's going to be interesting as well.
Austin?
The only thing that I would add to that is notice, though, and this is a part of the theme that is still driving through Hamas and Hezbollah, and I'm certain that it's supported by Iran, is blame somebody else for our systemic problems, and there the blame is placed on the Israelis. The Palestinians can make a case because they've been really at the social, economic, military confrontation with the Israelis since the formation of Israel in the late 1940s, but the outside pressure, in this case coming from Iran, is that don't look at our own, take responsibility for our own issues. Let's blame the Israelis, and that's the old technique. It's waned in Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, waning in Syria, waned in Iran as well. But again, you're looking now at 50-year-old propaganda that no longer has the traction it once had. And as we've covered the Palestinian civil war on Strategy Page, since Strategy Page began in August of 1999, go back and take a look at some of the files. Take a look at some of the not just the analysis of about the Israel-Palestinian issue, but some of the other columns and material that we've had, some of the discussion boards, which were quite lively, actually, maybe 7-8 years ago on this particular issue. The Palestinians are in the midst of their own constant civil war, and it doesn't break down just Fatah versus Hamas, even though we certainly saw that when Hamas shot so many Fatah operatives in Gaza and drove them out, and I think that was 2007, wasn't it, when we started talking about Gaza as Hamastan and the line.
Yeah.
But there are other factions within the Palestinians as well. And not too surprisingly, there are plenty of Palestinians that note prior to the Intifada that reignited in the late 1990s, there was increased economic cooperation with the Israelis between Jordan, West Bank, Palestine, and Israel, and there were a lot of benefits to that. And there's that component as well. Now, those folks, they're just the sad case of the moderate in these extenuating circumstances, is the moderate gets shot at by all sides. And yet, the moderate force, and I'm put that in italics, is one that says, hey, we need economic revitalization. That's what's going to give us the kind of life that we want. It'll turn on the electricity. They don't have oil there in the West Bank, but we'll get the electricity back on. We'll start making some money. Sidebar on this, Palestinians have a comparatively high level of advanced, I mean, college-educated individuals, in part because of their situation with not having an oil economy, and they have taken jobs throughout the rest of the Arab world at a technical level. They've got a tremendous amount of entrepreneurial expertise that if you could reach a stable situation, a political situation with the Israelis, it'd be quite productive. The thing is, an outsider like Iran and Syria up to now has no interest in seeing the Palestinians prosper. They have no interest, therefore they push all the extremist groups to keep things, keep the pot boiling. And until the Palestinians have a Palestinian spring, and I'm meaning this in a very positive way, Dan, and said, look, we're going to take on those elements that seek to continually destabilize us, and we're take on the same kind of spirit that we saw in Tunisia in 2011, you're going to have the kind of continual decline and degradation that Jim described.
Right. And
I hate to make it sound so dire, but shoot, that's what's going on. Jim?
I mean, there is no real economy in the Gaza Strip area.
Well, there is. There is. They get a lot of money from expatriate Palestinians. A lot of the foreign aid organizations, the UN, the NGOs and what have you, they hire local people. There's a lot of millions of dollars in foreign aid. There are some actually very nice looking areas of the Gaza, which don't, the news people don't take pictures of them because the whole story on Gaza is that it's a terrible place of suffering. But a lot of people live rather well. I've seen the photos.
The photos of those villas that are out there along the Mediterranean.
Yeah. People go to the beach and what have you, and there's economic activity. And a lot of the Palestinians realize that as long as they fire rockets at Israel all the time, the Israelis are going to do what anybody would do. They're going to close the border. They're not going to let, terrorists into their territory. But how do you argue with somebody who's a fanatic and has a gun pointed at your head? And therein lies the problem. And as Austin was saying, at least now the Arabs realize the problem, but now comes the problem of execution. Who's going to actually do something about it? And that is proving to be a difficult obstacle to overcome.
And mainly because when you oppose these groups, you get called... you get killed and called...
traitor.
At best, you get called, anti-Muslim.
Yeah, anti-Islamic, so. What have you. But people are starting to stand up to that. But, what a lot of people fear is that the Muslim world will do what, the Christians did and go through a period which lasted several centuries of religious wars between your religious factions. Although they were all those wars of religion were also wars of regular politics, real estate, et cetera, power, and what have you. Everybody, both Muslim and non-Muslim, is looking for a way to avoid that particular developmental stage. But right now, that's where it seems to be heading. So we got to keep our fingers crossed.
Nobody wants to live through the 30-year war again.
No, exactly. Not with nuclear weapons.
Yeah, the decimation would be much greater.
Exactly.
Well, I think that's a good place to end it, and I think we'll be following up on this definitely throughout the month as things happen in the UN and the like, and also with Libya. I'm sure Syria is going to be popping back up on our scope here soon. So we'll talk to you next time, gentlemen.
Right. Bye. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye.